Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Apparently it's a National Pie Day over in America. I don't know if both of you have seen this, but in the spirit of the Entitled Banter podcast, the UBP, the UBP, the UBP, people send over notifications that it's National Pie Day, but they spelt it PI, which makes me think it's more of a mathematical term. I don't want to
dive in. It is. It's March the 14th is National Pie Day because it's 3.14. Is that, have you not heard this before? This is old school.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, National Pie Day.
Any excuse to have a nice little slice of pie, but this is the UBP. I am Scott Tilford, your host, joined by Cy White.
Hello.
And joined by Josh Brown.
Were either of you two good at maths? I wasn't that great.
Terrible. Terrible.
I wasn't too bad, but I don't know, every now and then I think I'm all right at it, and then I'll do some sort of equation that actually matters, like I'm balancing something to do with workload or whatever, and I'll completely overlook a thing and be like, just zap it all off, just stop asking me to do it.
Yeah, I'm that person who opens the calculator app at any given notice, like any amount of addition that I have to do, and like, no, I don't trust myself.
Hey, I do have a question for you both, and the audience, of course, because if it is National Pie Day, and yeah, it might not be the correct pie that we're talking about, but controversial take to start this podcast off with, not a huge fan of sweet pies. Don't like pies with apple in them, don't like pies with cream on them.
Cherry
I want
pie?
Some just, no cherry pie, just mince, please, mince and gravy. And meat.
I did want to ask this to open the podcast, because we did get people saying Happy Pie Day, what are your favourite pies? I thought it would open the podcast anyway. But I think cherry pie is very overrated. Coming at it from, you know, there's that song that sings about it. You see people having cherry pies in like cartoons and then just in general. I just feel like when I finally got there, I was like, it's nowhere near as satisfying as I was led to believe.
Simon, this was brought up yesterday. You made a good point that it might be emblematic of the North-South divide in this country. Whether you like,
what isn't emblematic of that?
It's true. Whether you like a sweet pie or whether you like a savoury pie. But I've never even really had cherry pie, to be fair. I was just talking out my arse there. I don't know if that's supposed to be good, supposed to be bad.
Yeah, so what's your favourite pie?
Meat pie seems like such a northerner thing from where I am. Not that it doesn't exist down here, and I'll take any and all pie you give me, to be honest. Just give me any and all pie. I love a cherry pie. The thing about an apple pie is obviously the other easy sweet go-to. It's like they can be so hit and miss depending on how chunky those pieces of apple are. That can be a real pie turn-off, but cherry pie usually always good.
I think I've described my texture rule before, but if I'm biting through something, I want a consistent texture all the way through. I don't want something getting jarred in the way. Like if it's quite a soft, sweet thing, I don't want something hard in the middle of that.
Scott, you said something mental the other day.
Sounds like me.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? We were talking about crisps.
It sounds like the crisp sandwich debate all over again.
Yeah, like it was just impressive to me that we were talking about eating crisps, which are chips if you're an American listener. And, you know, we were talking about how uncomfortable it can be, similar to your texture thing there, to bite into a crisp and get a tough shard of it stuck up a gum or at the roof of your mouth. And you said you've never experienced that, and that is wild to me. It is something that is deeply ingrained into my fear factor in my brain.
I went to school with a man who was off school because he ate a sharp chip. but that's never happened to me. So I can only learn from the mistakes of others.
I like that you described him as a man. I'm thinking of him as like an undercover cop.
Yeah, he's just a guest worker who was taken out by a rogue chip. We should probably get through some questions. We have a nice bevy of questions. Lovely response from everybody. Massive thank you to everybody for sending in the various questions on video games, food, etc. First one from Matt Eddy, who says, my local game store is closing down soon, which means I won't have a place in my hometown to pick up physical copies of new games on release day. I'm very sad about this. Should I be more open to the increasingly digital landscape? Si, what do you think about the divide?
And I mean no horribleness by this, but I'm almost kind of tired of this conversation just because it's beaten me down. Right. Like it's been a never-ending debate, and I think we're going to get stuck in it forever because it sucks. Because I am a big proponent of physical because it's a big part of, you know, backwards compatibility and preservation and stuff like that. And every time you hear, you know, gamer reducing staff or closing down stores or whatever, it sucks to hear. So I feel for that person, absolutely. I'm still quite resistant where I can be and try to buy physical, but even then, you now and then you go, oh, it's right in front of me, digital's on offer, might as well, I guess. And I think that's my main thing.
It's definitely the immediacy of it. It's just that I want to jump between four or five different games. My thing is that you lose the ability to trade in. Like, it's not like we have a digital replacement for a trade in. Like, you don't have any value after something's finished. But Josh, what do you buy a lot of physical stuff, but usually from stuff that's 30 years old.
Yeah, that's it usually. It's because, you know, you can't get, for whatever reason, fear effect on the PlayStation 5 store. But I kind of got strong-armed into the digital landscape. Like, I resisted it. So, like, a lot of people, like the person who asked this question, for like the longest time, because I just didn't want to buy into it because I love my physical collection. I didn't like the idea that it could just be erased at any time. But then the pandemic hit and the convenience of it was just, you know, brought to my attention on a huge scale. And now the majority of the games that I buy and play are digital. And a part of me kind of resents that because I do champion physical media whenever I can. But another part of me just can't deny the convenience of it, especially in an era where install sizes are so huge. It is and this is one of those 1% problems, but I just find it exhausting now to have to swap the disc, install the disc, wait for all that to kind of go through and then play it. There's something, the ease of just being able to click a button, have that download go and have it accessible from the dashboard, I find that very, very appealing right now. But I will rue the day when the PlayStation Store goes offline and a lot of these games that I own are delisted and I can't access them ever again. You know, I know I keep bringing this game up, but every time I go into CEX and see Spider-Man Web of Shadows for £85, I think Dan Durkin has the right idea. But having that huge collection that he has is, you know, going to definitely be the right move in the long run. But yeah, man, I think we're sort of fighting against the tide at this moment in time because digital is the way forward. You look at the sales data and it's like that is here to stay and it's going to become the majority, unfortunately.
Yeah, like digital is like 90% of all retail now or something.
Yeah,
like as someone who's watching Final Fantasy VII Rebirth sales tanking, I'm still waiting for digital stuff to come in there. But I feel like overall the big question around streaming as well as a whole thing, like actually making sure that's stable. But streaming's got a lot better than it used to be.
I'll tell you what as well, and this is definitely because I'm an anxious mess, but I don't like going into game shops anymore. And, you know, the question mentioned games specifically there, because I hate having to say no when you are upsold. I just kind of, if I could go in, buy the game, and they'd be like, thank you, have a nice day, I'd be sound. But I find it difficult to say no to people. So when they're like, do you want a year's warranty? Do you want to like protect this disc and all of that stuff? Do you want to buy this as well? I'm like, there's only so much I can't resist at all. I'll end up buying something I don't want. And it's I worry about that, but that's a very specific case.
Just you taking insurance premiums out on the Sopranos game on PS2 just in case it gets scratched.
I don't know how you two deal with this, but you know when you're in kind of like a city centre or a town and you get those people who are just kind of like trying to sell you broadband or trying to sell you a service. I especially back in the day I'd find it impossible to just say no, so I'd talk to them for like 10 minutes, get to the end where they want my details, and then I'd make up some excuse and I'd be like, I don't actually do this, but I just felt I wanted to be polite, but then that's worse because I'm wasting their time.
It's probably worse, isn't it? You're wasting everybody's time. Head down, look at the floor, I don't see you, I don't exist, you know. Just I also don't, I buy most of my games physically through like online stores anyway. Occasionally I'll go in game and have a look around, but I understand why they've done it, but they've kind of become like something else entirely now. They're toy stores and they have like a whole section for like hanging out and playing games, which is kind of cool. Like some of it pivots a good way, some of it pivots a bad way, but yeah, the landscape very much has changed.
I don't know. Yeah. It's kind of like, again, I've been sort of strong-armed into buying digitally, but I find sort of two things with physical game stores, and I don't know how true this is across the board because it's been a few years since I religiously bought physical games, but I used to find when I would go for a big release, it seemed like actual physical game shops like Game would stock fewer and fewer copies, which meant those games sold out way more. Like I remember going for something as innocuous as the Crash N-Sane trilogy on launch day, and it was sold out of Game, it was sold out of Argos, like it was just kind of sold out across the board because I guess the demand is lower, so they get fewer copies in, so things sell out more. And that was kind of a thing that pushed me towards digital as well, because I had too many experiences where I was hyped to get a game on launch day and then I had to get it the day after. You know, which again isn't the end of the world, but it's just an inconvenience that digital doesn't have.
Yeah, to that end as well, I do miss like the hype of a midnight launch where you actually had to go down. And I'm probably too old for it now. Even if there was one on, I probably wouldn't even do it. But I used to do so many midnight launches, like GTA San Andreas, Halo 3, whatever. And like I used to love that energy of like everyone's just getting in at midnight. They've got some bundle deals on. There's some stupid T-shirt with a logo on that, yes, I do want for an extra £30. And so like I kind of miss that. I feel like we're never going to get that back. Like you can kind of have some of the everyone's playing it at once stuff at midnight or whenever the launch time is. But then most of the time now, games don't even launch at midnight. It's like 3 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever. And so I do lament missing that stuff. But we had a question from Andrew J, who says a favorite dad joke, which I'm prepping to be a dad. I've got one ready in the chamber, so I can fire one off. So it depends if you've got one ready to go.
Yeah, go on, Scott, because I think I don't know what dad joke you're about to drop off, but no one is better at the art of the pun than you. This guy has puns for days. He's got business ideas up the wazoo based around pun titles, and they're all exceptional.
Thank you. I never remember any of them. They're gone as soon as I say them. They're like little whispers in the wind. But, I don't know if anyone has heard about the scarecrow that got a promotion, but he was outstanding in his field.
Oh,
so
class,
take that one
good.
With you.
Go on, side.
I got one actually, coincidentally, strangely, yesterday evening, the First Aid Spray Discord server became Tell Us Your Dad Jokes.
Right.
So this one, credit to this one, I never heard this before, goes to Mr. Thomas. This is a very UK-specific one. You might not necessarily get this unless you understand the language pun, but I walked into a baker shop and noticed that one of the cakes was twice the price of the others. I said to the baker, "How come all of your cakes are 50p, but that one's £1? He said, "That's Madeira cake."
Very, very
horrible,
good.
But also incredible.
I thought it was brilliant. Yeah,
I like the whole the metric of measuring a dad joke is in groans. It's like it's in like what's the most you can make someone go, "Oh, for God's sake!" If you got that, then you've nailed a really good dad joke. Question from Nate the Gamer, who says, "Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, discuss. Its critical score is huge. I really like the OG FF7 and really enjoy Final Fantasy VII Remake, but I really get the sense of bloat in Rebirth to the point that I'm almost dropping off. I finished this game, so I'm not going to do spoilers. But Sai, you're about 3/4." Of the way in?
Yeah. Man, depends where you are. The amount of bloat gets pretty intense. I'm about 60 hours into my playthrough on chapter 10 or 11 of about 18. So
there's 40 in total, but it feels like 55.
Right, okay.
Like, yeah,
I know there's lots more left to go. And I started out, and I think I said this before when we did a bit of a pod on it a couple of weeks ago. I started out doing I'm going to 100% this game for some stupid reason. I was really excited at the top and I was like, I'm going to do everything. And yeah, now 60 hours in, I absolutely regret that decision. I'm going to have to cut it off. It's just too much. And it's too much of the same stuff.
Yes,
it's very, very padded, unfortunately.
I made a second save when I was just in the open world before it sort of got into the final third or final quarter, where I was like, I'm going to reload this save. This will be my everything save if I just want to mop up trophies and stuff. But I do think if you're trying to do everything, which like we're both very much fueled by our love of Final Fantasy VII.
So absolutely.
Like, of course I want to see everything, but that's the direct feeling that is the most abused as a fan. Like as the way this game is designed is just to abuse your time. Like I started to hate all that stuff, especially because it's just the same thing thing over and over again. Like, the open world goals don't change, and then the actual quest and level design is largely horrible, apart from, well, even the main stuff to me is still horrible. It's just that the story stuff is more worthwhile. Yeah, I think that it's interesting. I've been keeping an eye on all the completion data on the trophies, the chapter progress and everything, and then looking at the sales, like, it's had like a 90% drop in sales, only physically, but in the UK and in Japan. And then I've just noticed that on the PlayStation Store, it's not even trending. And it's just, I'm just curious, like, is the word of mouth out there where people just aren't getting to it yet? Like, even friends that I've got who played through FF7 who've now admitted they didn't actually finish it and then said, like, oh, I'm not too bothered about getting Rebirth. I wonder if that's a permeated feeling where if you're not there for the original or didn't finish Remake, you're not rushing out to get it, or you just don't care at all. I remember some of the mismarketing stuff in 2020 about how people, you know, realized on launch day that it wasn't even the full game, even though it's called Final Fantasy VII Remake. And I think that might be part of the conversation as well. But yeah, for me, if you like the original, you want to see what they've done with the story, it's worth checking that out. But I can't lie that I had the worst time playing this. Yeah. I think this was a horrific slog.
Yeah.
Like, just an ugly, ugly game. Like, I felt my own fandom for Final Fantasy VII evaporate by the end of it. So it's
My God.
It's a thermonuclear detonation to my love of this thing.
Yeah, the alarming thing for me was, I think it was yesterday, our colleague Joe basically just said, should I get it? Like, you know, I enjoyed Remake. Would you recommend it? And I couldn't, yeah, when that question was asked, like, I don't think I could say yes to that. That's where I'm at.
No, both of us were like,
I don't think I could recommend this game. It's just, there's too much that just sucks about it.
I will say,
a bunch of stuff that I like, but it's just, I'm not.
That's
the thing. I don't think I am enjoying it, which is unfortunate because I started out really on a high with it, but it's beaten me down.
I think, yeah, me and you were saying, like, it's it gets in its own way so much. Like, the combat's immaculate, the character writing is great, there's wider storytelling is a different thing. But there are great stints in it. I feel like I've had good stints. It's just that if I pie charted it, most of it is horrific. What the hell are you guys doing? You've messed that scene up as well. Oh, cool.
Cool, you've like, ruined all my favourite parts of the game.
Yeah.
Where I'm at. Yeah.
You've done them differently, and that's worse, and it's just so clearly worse, even if I try and take it as its own thing. But Josh, what are your quick thoughts on this? I know you've not started yet, but as you're someone who is just surveying the insanity so far.
No, I mean, that's my biggest problem with modern Final Fantasy. Again, I can't comment on Rebirth, but the one thing I was hoping that Rebirth wouldn't repeat from Remake was that bloat, was that sense of filler, was that sense of repetition. I wanted the side missions to be way more focused, and man, I just want to outright love a Final Fantasy game that I have played, because each one, similar to what you were saying there, Scott, like, I've loved parts, I've loved stints, I've loved even the game as a whole, but there have been so many times where I've thought, like, this could have been so much tighter. This could have not even been in the game at all. You could have excised this. I think, you know, that maybe there's an expectation in the industry right now that games, and especially RPGs, need to be a certain length, need to have so much content in them. But to me, if these games had, you know, like, were 20 hours, were 40 hours max, everything included, side quests and all, I just feel like they would be a bit, I don't know, a bit more focused. But then would you have a section of the fandom, a section of the crowd saying, well, that's no longer a JRPG if you don't have all of these extra things?
Pulled it off for the decades until now. It never used to be this obviously bloated and, like I said, abusing of your time. Like, I mean, the best Final Fantasies are still the old school ones. Like, those are the ones that I would still recommend wholeheartedly, like going from 1 all the way to 10. There's dips in quality, but, you know, just as packages, they're so much more worthwhile. Like, this is just, this is so nakedly filler. There's so much Ubisoft open world design in here. It just gets, I want to use the word insulting, because it's like, it just, to me, it just feels like, well, you're going to put up with this, aren't you, because you like Final Fantasy VII. And it's like, that's the exact feeling that I just kept getting, where I was like, this is turgid, but I'm just putting up with it because it's VII. And that's very much speaking from a place of, I just finished it like 2 days ago, but I hated so much of this thing.
Wow.
So I can't pretend I didn't.
There's a group of people out there, like, and I completely understand this, who the value that they place on a game is like, I spent this many pounds on it. If I were to play it for this many hours, pound an hour or whatever, then it's worthwhile. And you're seeing an issue potentially with that way of thinking here. Because as I said, I've put 60 hours into this. I haven't made my money back if it was a pound an hour yet. And yeah, I'm nowhere near done with it. And not in a good way. not in a good way.
No, and I think that that's a really good conversation, because I definitely personally don't ascribe to that. I think I wouldn't want to pay £70 for a 2-hour game, but if that was the best 2 hours I ever spent, I could have an argument about that, as opposed to just here's some bloat, here's some filler for the sake of giving you 100 hours of nonsense. But I'm curious. Like, Josh, you're going to play it going forward, I think.
See how you feel. To be honest, I'll probably end up 100%ing it, and I'll probably end up burning out on it, kind of like how I did that. Remake don't and kind of how I did Final Fantasy 16. Man, there were so many moments in 16 where I was doing those side missions just thinking, why? why am I putting myself through this when the main content is so good? But I'm always a person who, if the content is there, and you know, I'd almost feel bad ignoring it in a way. That's the way my brain works with these games. But yeah, I think there's something to be said about just industry expectations as a whole, and I think it's important to remember that this is still Square Enix at the end of the day. Like, the developers can be as talented as they want, but if they're getting directives from above, and I'm not saying this definitely happened on this game, but if you look at their products across the board, it feels like, you know, they're very aware of what the market is doing, they're very aware of current trends, and I do think they're looking at game length and looking at, like you said, you know, successes in other open world games and what's expected, quote unquote, from an open world game, and maybe going, well, we can't cut this out. This is a convention we need, or a trope we need to have in there, or people might reject it because, you know, I think a game with a sort of singular vision and really curated content right now is so rare, and it's annoying because by the sounds of it, that's kind of what made Final Fantasy so special in the first place. The tightness of it, the inventiveness of it, that is not really there at the moment, I guess.
Yeah, and I think the best parts of this are when they're closer to that blueprint, or they're closer to the narrative beats, when the character writing matches the story pace and you actually feel like you're invested in something, as opposed to just, you know, oh, the floor's dropped out again and now we're in this other dungeon for 3 hours or whatever it is. I think that's curious, because it's like you've got the original team who like contributed obviously to the original Final Fantasy VII. Some roles have changed around, like Tetsuya Nomura's gone from artist to creative director, and it's like I think it's interesting looking at the quotes they said across the last few years, and even before Remake, like when it was showing off and then before it came out, where they said like we can't do this if we don't do this now, we're not getting any younger, we need to do it now. And I wonder how much it's just that thing of like, let's just go all out, every NPC, every remote reference that was ever made to anything Final Fantasy VII, we will blow it all the way out, and this is like a one and done. But I remember them also saying they didn't know how many installments they were going to do, and there was even mention of it being 5 or 10 or whatever. And now it's 3, but it's still huge, and then you've got all the 10th anniversary era stuff in there as well. So it's, I think the whole thing's fascinating. I think it's one of a kind in terms of the amount of money that you can, the money that's dripping off it in every scene, every character render and everything. But it doesn't make for an engaging product whatsoever. But still, question from Couchy. This is kind of like links into what we said. What's better, longer and better game experiences for more money, or shorter and smaller, cheaper games? No right answer, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'm all for shorter, smaller, cheaper stuff personally.
It's tough, because I don't want to have a cop-out answer and say both, you know? It feels like a cop-out, but I do think both. You know, I'm loving right now jumping into a shorter game like Cannibal Abduction, which is £5 on the PlayStation Store and takes an hour and a half to complete, alongside, you know, those bigger 80 to 100-hour games. So I like a long game as long as it's respectful of my time. I don't like a game that is just bloated out. And something like Elden Ring, you know, that was still serving me up brand new, bespoke, amazing content 120 hours in, whereas other games like Assassin's Creed Valhalla are just repeating a loop for 100 hours. So that's where I have a problem with the bloat. And I do think generally games could probably be like 10% shorter, just as a blanket statement, because if every game was 10% shorter in the AAA space, I'd have loved Days Gone way more. I'd have loved Assassin's Creed Valhalla way more. But I think, you know, I think one of them informs the other. You know, shorter games are appreciated between the big games, but if you're, like you were saying, if you're paying $70, it is satisfying to know that, well, this might last me 2-3 months to get through. Yeah. And as long as it's not becoming a job for you, then I'm totally fine with longer games.
So what do you think?
Yeah, massively agree, to be honest. I'm at the stage, obviously this year, sort of, we had Yakuza come out, Final Fantasy VII, Dragon's Dogma comes out in a couple of weeks or whatever, a week now. So it's like big, heavy RPG sort of beginning to this year. So I'm going to need some small games, definitely. I'm going to need to look into some small games after this, because, yeah, lots of big potentially, for better or for worse, who knows, you know, in these games with a lot offering a lot of content, sometimes you just want a game where it's like, yeah, I've seen the credits. Amazing. Yeah, you know, I actually got there.
That feeling of actually seeing credits is such a rare... It depends on the genre, but like when it is a humongous game, like maybe you'll see credits, but you know there's a bunch of side stuff left, or maybe the main quest was a way of pushing you into the open world afterwards. So it's like, okay, I've seen some of it, but I should just play forever kind of thing. Yeah, I think it's, for me, it's definitely like... does it feel like it values my time?
Yeah, totally.
And then I think where we are in the industry, I'm too aware of all the issues with crunch and unnecessary bloat and money being put into the wrong things and general attitudes that go into creating a game of a certain size and trying to get it where the team actually really wanted to make something that was that big, which ironically is the team behind Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, like from everything that they're saying. I think that can get in the way sometimes where I'm playing through something that's just of a certain size, just being like, this didn't need to exist like this. We could have all been a lot happier when you were making this under better conditions and the playing experience that would have come through on the player side. But that's always case by case.
Spider-Man 2, sorry, yeah. Great example of a game where I did everything in that, got the platinum, which is a very rare thing for me, had a great time, was not overly long. Like, it was about the perfect amount of content.
Yeah, I would say that Spidey 2 was something where I got so sick of the weird little cutaways, and now you're going to ride a bike for a bit and whatever. But like,
that's in the main story, though. Like, when you don't want that stuff when you're like scooping up the extras. The release of the extras were consistent.
That's actually such a good comparison. Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is if you took all the ancillary parts of Spidey 2 and then made them all the stuff you have to do, or do like 10 of each one of them. But Spidey 2 at least did not stay its welcome, as well, I was going to say. It felt like a nice, like, focused chunk of game. Mm. A question from Derek, who says, have we taken the Knock Loose pill yet? I've been listening to them since their first EP, and they've only grown on me both in talent and popularity since then. They just dropped a new single for an upcoming record in May, and it rules with a lot of U's.
Man,
Josh, you're a fan.
Yes, yeah, and you know what? This is Knock Loose is a band that when I first heard them on record, like they were a little too heavy for me. I'm not going to lie, you know, I've got to confess that. And I thought they were pretty good, but I didn't necessarily get the hype. And then I saw them live at a festival, and then that just unlocked it for me massively. And I was like, wow, this is next level. So I've been a huge fan of them since then. And I was talking about them with the wrestling channels and legend of the game, Andy Murray, in the office the other day, because he was the one who put me on these new singles, and he was saying, so I'll just paraphrase what he said to me. He said he loves it how, you know, they've gotten this success now, they've gotten so big, and it's just made them weirder, it's just made them more experimental, and they've made their sound more brash and abrasive, and I love a bit of that, and I can't wait to see them live again, man.
I need to check them out. Si, have you heard of listened to Knock Loose?
Yeah, I'm very aware of them. I've not really dug too deeply into it, and I probably should. And one of the reasons why, and this is very much a me problem and a very weird me problem as well, is that their singer Brian Garris, I think his name is, his vocals apparently sound a lot like me when I do harsh vocals.
Ooh.
So all my friends go, oh, that's you, and I'm like, oh,
that's cool.
So anytime there's Knock Loose on, like, this yapping chihuahua vocal that he's got, I'm like, cool, thanks. So it's like, it's hard, but I he appears on a lot of like songs with bands that I do regularly listen to, and I always like his stuff there. So you say that they're getting weirder as well and more abrasive. I'm like, do you know what? I probably need to give them a proper time of day. It's one of those bands that if I start listening to, I would just fall down the rabbit hole. So I need to make sure I'm ready for that.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I need to go back around, because the last time that JB recommended someone, it was like Turnstile and then 100 Gex. So you're doing very well.
Yeah,
on 100 the recommendations.
Gex was the one for me. I was not expecting that.
No, but that stuff comes together really well. Question from Paul McSoul, who says, Happy Friday. IGN had an article this week that Resident Evil 5 can't be remade because it has dubious themes at the time, which have grown worse since. It would need a full rewrite. Can we judge older games or any art by modern standards?
I've seen this too in the rounds, and I think it's an interesting one. And I think it's important to note that this is coming from the perspective of a white guy. And I would definitely, you know, recommend you checking out writing and insight from people of color on the internet, because they're going to be way more insightful than I am. But to me, the issue with Resident Evil 5 is, like Paul was mentioning there in the IGN piece mentions, like, it's interesting because sometimes we look at a piece of art that hasn't aged well and you change it, you know, because I think the role of a remake to me is to look at an older game and or a movie or whatever, and you kind of like look at what worked and look what wouldn't work in a modern context and try to just update and modernize and offer a new perspective on the same material. That's what a remake should do to me, rather than just give you the exact same thing beat for beat. So when it comes to Resident Evil 5, I think it's interesting that there was criticism surrounding this area back in the day, and yeah, that has intensified over time, but I think you can remake the game with that in mind. Like, I think that's I think the game would only benefit from that sort of criticism about its themes, about its, you know, representation and the way that it depicts those things, in the same way that you would analyze its sort of level design, and, you know, you would tweak that, kind of like how Resident Evil 4 and Resident Evil 2 did. I think I was, you know, reading the IGN piece before we jumped in, just so I knew what it was about, and that piece, while of course it mentions the depiction of people of color and Africa as a, you know, a continent within the game, it also is about, you know, its level design. It's talking about more than just the themes. It's not necessarily saying it simply can't be remade because of that aspect. It's a bunch of fundamental issues with Resident Evil 5 that kind of make it a harder adaptation than something like Resident Evil 4 or something like Resident Evil 2.
So what do you think?
Yeah,
as a bigger Resident fan?
Yeah, it is important to say that we're talking from perspective of privilege here, as it is. My perspective on it has always been that obviously Capcom never intended to do anything offensive. What they probably did was stuff that was very tone deaf, and they didn't necessarily realise that, and they could do with a bit more forethought when it comes to those things, which they had admitted at the time. I think they said you know, that their PR team would be heavily involved in narrative stuff going forward to make sure that they didn't kind of accidentally put their finger in something again, because I think they realised after perhaps some defending it what they'd kind of done, and they're going to be very aware of all of this, because this is not the only article about this, and they're immediately when the teasers of Resident Evil 5 Remake, whether or not that's going to happen, sort of came about, everyone started talking about, well, can you do that, how would you do that, what would you change, and there are things that probably could stand to change. I don't think the idea of setting a game in Africa itself, that's, in fact, if they avoided that completely, and that would almost be more offensive, really.
Yes.
But obviously there are some tone deaf stuff. There's some tone deaf stuff from the original version that could stand to be reevaluated and come out from a different angle. And I think in general, the Resident Evil, well, Capcom in general, I'd say, have been very good of that. Over the last few years, they've been a lot more, I don't know, the way they've handled things is just a lot more carefully and a lot more respectfully, while also honouring the source material, but not making an idiot of themselves, thankfully. And there are a few Resident Evil games where they could stand to do that with remakes that are potentially coming up. The easy answer for me to avoid this would just be don't remake the game because it doesn't need a remake. That's where my stance. Lots of people asking me about Resident Evil 5 Remake is I just don't want it personally. But
yeah,
you know, if it's going to happen, I think they will do right by it.
Yeah, I'm curious what they do in terms of like the really crazy stuff, like the boulder punching was like such a huge thing at the time. Like I remember all the discourse at the time about the general depiction of white character goes in and kills many black people. Mm-hmm. Like there's obviously part of that that is geographically located or whatever. I feel like the general approach back in the day was a lot less aware of cultures and a lot less aware of you know, doing the right research on the area. But I have no idea. I can't speak to the reality of how they put it together. But I think it's my assumption is that it is closer to what you said, Si, where it's like they didn't necessarily realize the way some of that stuff was going to come across. And I think especially in the 2000s or before we were all more connected, sharing stories online over time, it was easier to just go like, well, it's going to be set here and look at all these potential depictions of tribes. We can pull this mask. We can do these things. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't we kind of thing? And I think that was just the state of that discourse back then. And no one, in theory, meant to do wrong by people. But I think it's easy to address that now because all the information, the experience, the shared culture, etc., is much easier to actually do respectfully. So, yeah, I don't think it... Like, you saw Wings of the Internet take this as like, oh, my God, the wokening of RE5. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure it's not going to be... I'm pretty sure it's going to be done well by a team of professionals who have been doing this for a long time.
Resident Evil 5, the villain, is a white supremacist and he gets blown up with two rockets in a volcano.
Yeah.
So it's fairly woke as it is.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah. I think my thing with all of this is that I'm curious about what they do in terms of, like, the more divisively received Resident Evils overall. Like, there's obviously the racial element to it. I think there's different ways to approach that. But I'm curious in terms of the gameplay, the wider stuff, the level design, like you said, Josh. For me, when I went back to RE5, because I bought it on Switch over Christmas, was just how similar it was to RE4. Like in terms of the main plot beats and what I'm doing. And like even when the chainsaw dude appears, it's like the same kind
of
scenario.
The first few missions have got a lot of like, hey, remember this from the game from 4 years ago? And like, yeah, still do, thanks.
Yeah, exactly. Good, and I'm like, if you're going to go back there, like I love the setting of RE5. Like, I liked how like increasingly action-focused it was. So yeah, I'm curious about that stuff. And for me, like this whole remake trajectory that they're on, I want them to tackle the more divisive ones. I am curious about what you do with an RE5, even though that was a solid enough game, but mainly what you do with RE6, because I think that thing had a lot of promise, a lot of different ways to play, lots of different characters.
Conversations to be had about Resident Evil 5 Remake, and as I say, does it need to be made? Do you need to remake earlier entries first? Because Wesker, this is his first appearance. You know, he shows up at the end of RE4 Remake, spoiler, I guess. But he'll have his proper crowning moment in Resident Evil 5 Remake. But you kind of need older games to set that up. And there'll be lots of people that haven't played Resident Evil 1 and Code Veronica where that story comes to pass. Do you need that or do you not? Is that unnecessary because he's just a crazy supervillain that you need to blow up with two rockets in a volcano?
Well, he's like the mystery dude at the end of RE4 Remake, so I guess you could do it that way and just do the cutscenes differently. But that is a talking point as to whether they go back and remake RE1 again, but like RE2, 3, 4, and do the over-shoulder camera and do it that way. Maybe. I think they'll just do it, Final Fantasy style, where you just change the depiction and just he explains his motivations.
They just kind of tell you. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, like you've got Ada reporting to him at the end of RE4R anyway. But Josh, any final thoughts?
A couple. You've both said some really interesting points, I think. Going back to the question just very briefly, I think it's important to have a distinction between a remake and a remaster. You know, Resident Evil 5 has already been remastered. It's available on modern hardware, and I'm very much of the thought that if you re-release something with problematic parts of it, I would do what kind of Tomb Raider did, where you throw up a disclaimer to be like, this is like a product of its time. We're acknowledging this now, but here it is presented in its like current form. I'm pretty sure like Looney Tunes does that as well to a certain degree. But with a remake, I think, I just think if you're going to do a remake, the point is to kind of review things that worked and review things that didn't work. And like you said, they might not have intended that, or they might have been completely tone deaf at the time, but this is an opportunity to look at everything and kind of modernize it and update it. And I think with this remake sub-franchise that they've got going now, I think it's very easy to do that because they've already made huge changes. They've already changed the tone of that story. And I don't know how you both feel about this, but I think it's very much a Leon story at the moment. Obviously, you had Resident Evil 3 with Jill and you've got Claire and 2, but the way it the way Capcom directly linked 2 and 4 in Leon's growth over that, it does make me question 5 as a just a general story, because like, what do you do with Wesker? But also, what do you do with Chris? You don't have anything.
I hadn't even thought that.
In the remake sort of canon, and I'm not including the original remake in this, the one that originated on the GameCube, like, Chris is an unknown entity, more or less, even more so than Wesker. And we've met his sister, but we don't have that context with the Spencer Mansion. And, you know, Sheva was always a new character, of course, but, like, they're kind of both coming in to newcomers on equal footing there. So that relationship between Jill, that relationship between Wesker, that relationship between Chris is unexplored. So that's a tricky one to navigate with, like you said, without maybe Code Veronica or maybe even a remake of Number One, a new remake of it.
Yeah.
That would go back around to the idea of doing 6 eventually, because then you've got Leon coming back anyway and the continuation of him. So maybe the through line is Leon. I never really thought about it that way, but like that would be a way to do it. Yeah, the Tomb Raider approach I really like, because I think that sparks the relevant and most important conversations anyway. Like, I think I'm a big sort of context is everything kind of person, especially with older stuff. And I think that something like Tomb Raider, had some extremely simplistic and largely offensive reductionist depictions of certain tribes or cultures, etc. I think putting a disclaimer on the front of that, like I said, to me at least, sparks those conversations anyway in regards to, look how far we've come. Like, I think there's a lot of positive progress that can come out of those conversations. But like you said, Josh, it's that distinction between remaster and remake, and is it worth sticking to those guns back in the day? What were they informed by? What was the intent at the time? What was the context at the time? And have things moved on? It doesn't necessarily need to be a negative, the idea of reframing something. To me, a core example is, look at RE4 remake's depiction of Leon and Ashley's relationship. It's so much stronger and better and more respectful than, at least to me, the way Leon and Ashley are in the original. And if you go back, maybe, you know, some people, if you ever go back to the originals now, you'll kind of realize, man, okay, we've come a long way. And I think sometimes you don't realize it until you go back to something. I didn't until I went back through RE4.
Like, if that was about, the level design, there would be less few raw, you know what I mean? It's kind of in the same sort of bad faith criticism, I think, that comes with the people who, you know, were furious that you couldn't look up Ashley's skirt in Resident Evil 4. That kind of stuff is, I just think it's interesting that out of that IGN article, a lot of that criticism has latched onto, oh, they can't change the depiction of the characters, but that article, like I said, was as much about the level design and about the fundamental issues of the gameplay in Resident Evil 5 as it was about that. And I think, you know, in terms of the bad faith internet discourse, there's so much of that going around about diversity at the moment that I think it's important to kind of pinpoint that.
That's true. I think as well, for me, there's, all you can do is do your best at the time. I'm sure in another 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, there might be more information available, more ways to approach a respectful depiction of whatever culture or whatever, point they're pulling from. But I think, for me, it's the whole idea of can we apply modern standards? Yes, because that's us in the now applying the modern standards. But they could be viewed as outdated standards given another 10, 15 years. So I think all you can do is the best in the moment and hope that it stands the test of time and your heart was in the right place, which again, I'm sure that their heart was back in the day, but it's retrospectively, there are parts that could have been done better, which you would assume they would get addressed. A question from, this is going to be a hell of a pivot, from Screwy Loops, who says, who loves a bit of pot noodle on toast? What is the strangest food you've ever had on toast? Welcome to the Untitled Banter podcast, where only such a swerve can exist. Bigger swerves than AEW. Josh Brown, what do you think?
Pot noodle on toast. I'm not against it. I respect that you enjoy that. It wouldn't be for me. Sounds a bit dry.
Can you tell the people what you've consumed? I believe it was last night.
Listen, I was at home last night and I was talking to my girlfriend Talia, and she was saying, don't you go on the podcast tomorrow and talk about your bean sandwich. She was like, do not make this discourse. Because what Scott is referring to here is, yesterday I professed my love for a bean sandwich, which is exactly what it sounds like. It is baked beans in a bit of bread, not toast.
Me and Si, head in the hands.
It's not beans on toast. It's not toast in a sandwich. It's just one slice of bread, a layer of beans, fold it in half, have a good time. We were Googling it yesterday. And it turns out this is a meal, according to Wikipedia, that originates from 1908 in Boston, Massachusetts, which surprised me because it very much reminds me of like an English wartime meal.
Yeah, with like yeah, feels like the bombers are coming.
Literally, yeah, right. But yeah, man, if you like a pot noodle on toast, I like a bean on bread. So I'm all up for putting stuff on bread and just going to town on it.
Didn't you have a bread sandwich at one point?
Bread sandwiches are delicious, you know? You just
are they?
Like what? I know. Here we go, right. What I used to really like when I was growing up, it only works with white bread because you've got like the sugar and the sweetness of it, right? Just getting a slice of white bread, balling it up in your hands until it's solid, you know, and then kind of eating it like it's a profiterole or something.
And the
bread's gone all hard. And it
like
just tastes like
I'm
a dumpling side. Exactly. And eating it like that. So, yeah, I'm a bread freak, it seems. So, whatever you want.
The idea of balling bread up, like it's already been cooked and made and proved, but you've reproved it with your own juices,
hey,
is a hell of a thing.
The bread's already been cooked and proved, but you still toast it, and no one bats an eye at that.
The history would dictate. If it was a history of people balling up bread, then in some alternate universe, they'd be freaking out about John Brown talking about toast and his bread. But it's, I don't know. Sly, thoughts on this pot noodle toast, strangest food on toast?
I'm not going to judge anyone for their food habits. I'm not going to judge you for your pot noodle on toast, because otherwise we're really opening a can of worms when you guys talk about crisp sandwiches constantly.
Yeah.
And what
you know, a crisp sandwich, man?
Never, ever, ever. No, thank you. Never. No, sandwiches are for sandwiches only. Don't put noodles in them and crisps, you weirdos. Or do. I don't care. It doesn't affect me. Just, no. Weirdest thing I've put on toast is probably jam. Like, I mean, I just, what do you want? Butter. Like, that's about it. That's all that goes on toast. What do you
that
want?
Was the other discourse the other day, was Josh he doesn't like jam.
Actually, right, okay. Not weird. Weirdest in quotation marks, what I've been doing recently. Bit of bread. Tomato puree with some herbs, sprinkle some cheese on it, maybe some pepperoni or whatever. Another bit of bread, do the same thing again, put it in the air fryer for about 8 minutes. You've got like a little pizza toasty. That's probably the, quote, weirdest thing. And that's fairly normal.
That's an innovation. That's a revolution. That's a taste sensation. I think that'll do the rounds across the country, if not the world, to be honest, given the audience that we have.
This is it. Welcome, everyone.
I want to try that.
We're back to the north-south divide again, because Sai explains the weirdest thing she's ever put on bread and then suddenly describes this gourmet meal that is absolutely probably beautiful and yet slags off the crisp sandwich. I mean, Sai, is it just not good enough for your Sai? Is that the issue there?
I've neglected to mention that after I make that, after I quote unquote make that, I get my butler to bring it to me. So
you lock it in the fridge.
Yes.
Sai,
for old time's sake,
what you've got to do, get some bread. Don't bother putting any butter on it. Get some Pringles, flavour of your choice, whatever you like the most. Smash them together in some bread. Eat that sandwich. And as a lovely treat afterwards, because Pringles are absolutely outrageous in terms of their makeup and structure, they'll sprinkle a load of beautiful Pringle dust and crumbs all over the plate. And then you pull the plate up to your mouth, put your lips on the plate, and just...
You can't see what he's doing right now, but he's imitating some sort of flesh-based Hoover.
That's pretty much it. Turn your mouth into a flesh-based Hoover, and then just get the remnants, and it's what a treat. Mwah.
Remnants.
This weekend, Josh, for you, I will do that.
Thank you.
I will do that, and I will let you know how it makes me feel. It will probably give me flashbacks to the time in middle school, where we... had one of our friends, and we told him, put everything in your lunchbox in your sandwich and eat it, just for a gag, you know. And it was, I think, like cheese and onion crisps ham sandwich with a chocolate bar and a strawberry yogurt in it. It was disgusting.
That was tasty until the yogurt.
Too far.
I remember the chocolate and chip or chocolate and fry experimentation period in school, which wasn't that bad. You can still get some places that'll do you some chocolate topped fries.
I'll tell you what's truly demented and truly just, I'm fully kink shaming right now. is in The Irishman, there are so many, and it might just be like completely, you know, slagging off Italian American culture for all I know right now, but there's a bit at the end where they dip their bread into their wine. And I always thought, I always wanted to try it, but just like speaking it out loud, it sounds not for me. But next time I go to a restaurant, I'm going to go for a cheeky dip. Like, I guess it's just because wine is nice, and I'm imagining like dipping the bread into like a can of Foster's or something, which would be disgusting. But the
it's
wine
going to be the right type of bread. I feel like if I can get a nice big thick bit of bread, dip it in the wine with the olives on the side, I think that could actually be quite delightful. But it's you've got to get the consistency right. If you dip the bread and it falls in, then you've messed everything up.
That's it. We're talking about custard cream logic, aren't we? Like a little dunk was probably delicious, but if you're then drinking the wine and you've got a load of bread debris in there, like that's just not going to cut it for me. That's when I do kink shame it.
Every single time, and we've done this quite a lot this week, we talk about food. I feel food culture birthing itself. I just feel like it's going to be a thing at some point. It's not like the world doesn't have food opinions. Final question from... let's do another food question from CER Saturn. What, in your opinion, is the worst flavor of crisp, any brand?
Interesting. Oh,
Josh Bond, you were slagging off some thick crisps earlier in the week.
Yeah, I suppose that's not a flavor, but the thicker the crisp, the worse the crisp for me. When I was in Ireland, I finally tried Tato's, which are like the best width, the best girth, the best softness of crisps for me. But I don't think there are, I'm going to say this now, there are no bad flavoured crisps, but there are ones that are worse than others. And for me, I've never been a meat flavour crisp guy. I've never necessarily opted to go for, I don't know, beef and onion chicken flavored crisps, but I will eat them if they're there, but they are bottom of the pile for me.
I'll back that. I've never been a fan of the beef crisps. When I used to get Monster Munch, there was always that, was it beef Monster Munch?
Yeah.
And I was like, get them away from me. I want the flaming ones. Oh, really? I'll take pickled onion or the flaming ones, but I'm with Josh. Chicken crisps? Nah, meat crisps?
Some people really do find those beef Monster Munch absolutely gutted. Like, it would be sacrilegious to say this, I think.
They probably like Final Fantasy VII Remake, though. Or just get them away from me.
I'll eat all the Monster Munch. Give me all the flavours. Pretty great. Tell you what, the first bad flavour that comes to mind, it might be the only bad flavour, I don't know, but I think it was from like Lidl or Aldi or one of these places, but I bought, it was like honey glaze. No, it wasn't honey glaze ham. It was maple bacon. So in the same ballpark, but there's something about the sweetness on a crisp that just didn't. It just didn't seem right. I was like, this is odd. Not enjoying this. But other than that, yeah, generally speaking, not too much of a flavor Nazi, really.
At some point, you've got to bring standards in, but not yet. We need to try way more crisp brands. But yeah, for now, this has been the Untitled Banter podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Si White.
I just ended this podcast on those words. I apologise.
And joined by Josh Brown.
It's always a pleasure to do this, especially when we're talking about crisps for so long.
I was going to say, everyone can get in touch. Let us know your food opinions. We'll do more food questions. But if you want to see food culture be real at some point, you wave the flag. For now, thank you all very much. Have a lovely weekend, and we'll catch you very soon. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.